Вие сте со SBS на Македонски.
You're listening to a podcast on SBS Macedonian with Margarita Vasileva. In this compelling episode, we sit down with veteran media producer and broadcaster George Stamkoski, whose frontline reporting for UNTV during the brutal conflicts in the former Yugoslavia in 1994 exposed the harsh realities of genocide in Bosnia and Herzegovina. His first-hand experiences would later shape the influential book With No Peace to Keep, a landmark publication commissioned by the Open Society Institute and launched at the British House of Commons. Edited and published by Stamkoski, the book brings together insights from 30 global experts on the UN's complex peacekeeping efforts and failures during the Balkan Wars. We explore the critical moments that led to the book's creation, the shocking inaction witnessed by UN peacekeepers in Srebrenica, and how George's time with UNTV ignited a commitment to reporting on the region.
SBS.
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 SBS Radio. George, tell us about the time that you began reporting in Europe before the conflict in Yugoslavia.
Srebrenica, I arrived in London. I lived in Germany for a bit, studied there and worked on movies and TV programs and studied visual communications in Berlin when there was still a Berlin Wall. And then late 80s, I arrived in London and missed out on the Berlin Wall being pulled down. Just left. Oh. The whole time I thought, wouldn't it be wonderful if Berlin would be one big city again, like before the war? But I didn't think it was possible. And then it happened. It happened very quickly. And it was kind of part of the Cold War winding down at the time. But it was still brewing in different parts of the world, including Yugoslavia, a country that nobody thought would see a war of the scale that unfolded in the 90s, a place where that people knew as tourists. They love to go to the Adriatic coast, peaceful country, a relatively politically not so extreme Stalinist like some of the other neighbors in Bulgaria, Romania, Hungary, Eastern Germany. And it was a shock and a surprise. And it unfolded exactly 10 years after Tito died in 1990. In 1980, Tito died. 10 years later, yes, the war was brewing, and in the early 90s, that war began. Mm. So I arrived in England, and I saw that this war was brewing, and I remembered the words of my grandmother, who experienced the so-called Greek Civil War from 46 to 49 after World War II, which is actually the beginning of the Cold War, according to some historians. And she said, she told us as kids, she hoped that we would never see anything like that again in Europe. And I remembered her words, and I saw something like that unfolding in Europe again. And I felt obliged to report on it, go find ways to be there, rather than just sit back and say this is terrible and do nothing. Previously, I arrived in London, and there was a bit of a Macedonian community there that I connected with, and we lobbied for recognition of Macedonia. As you will remember, even though it's a long time ago, 35 years now, there was in early 90s, before Macedonia declared independence, there was a Greek economic embargo, and Greece vetoed the recognition of Macedonia as an independent state, a veto that lasted 28 years, we have to remind ourselves. And we lobbied for Macedonia to be recognized by Britain, and then America recognized it first, Britain followed, Australia recognized in 1995, and that's why next year we're having the 30th anniversary of diplomatic relations between Macedonia and Australia. So we were lobbying for that. I wrote some material about Macedonia. I actually wrote the report for BBC World Service, which led to the establishment of a Macedonian language service in BBC World Service at the time in the early 90s, which lasted a long time.
Yes.
And we did what we could. I did a first story for Channel 4 in the UK about the first Macedonian who died in the war when a helicopter was shot down in Slovenia. JNA, Yugoslav National Army helicopter was shot down by the Slovenes, a Macedonian died, and I did a story about their family and about the dilemma that Macedonia faced at the time, whether to try and stay in Yugoslavia and not provoke a conflict with Serbia or declare independence and risk being drawn into the conflict that was already unfolding in Croatia and Bosnia from 91 onwards. So I did a story on that, and I did other stories as well for Europe Express and for the BBC World Service. I was going down regularly to travel around Yugoslavia. In 91, actually, I did a program called Cold War in Yugoslavia for German TV, and it was about the fact that there was a Cold War brewing, and the question was, would it get hot? And if it escalates, and if a war is unleashed, how will it end? And I traveled all around Yugoslavia in every state, in Slovenia, Croatia, with my little camera, and I had some little 10,000 Deutschmarks advance from German TV, and I traveled everywhere, to Kosovo, to Macedonia, to Serbia, and interviewed political leaders, gun runners, religious leaders, media people, people on the street, about whether there's going to be a war. I thought it was funny at the time, even though that was my dark humor, perhaps. But the Serbs at the time in Belgrade were saying, oh, yes, there's going to be a war for sure. You know, we're going to fight that the other side. They're trying to tear apart Yugoslavia. We want our lands back. The Croats were like, no, there won't be a war. It'll be peaceful. We'll resolve this between ourselves. And the Macedonians were, how do we know? You know, they were just like in the dark as to how it was going to unfold. So I did a number of things in the media front on the war. And then in 1994, I got a job with United Nations TV and was posted in Zagreb, Croatia. United Nations TV was the biggest operation of the UN Division of Information since Cambodia. They set up TV programs, radio, print, and it was in all the languages of former Yugoslavia. And I produced TV content, others produced radio and print content, and it was all for the purpose of raising awareness within Yugoslavia about what the UN is doing in the region as a peacekeeping mission.
Yes.
And so I filmed all over former Yugoslavia. I did all of the reports in Macedonia because I was the only Macedonian in the team.
Mm. George, how did you manage to collect all of the contacts necessary for interviews? Were you assisted in any way, or was this sourced by yourself?
I did it by myself. Mm-hmm. I was a roving reporter. We didn't even have mobile phone in those days.
No.
We had to just phone wherever we had access to a phone, try and set up a meeting. People were surprisingly willing to talk because tension was building up and people had things to say from all sides of the eventual conflict. Mm-hmm. And I remember interviewing Janez Janša, who became the defense minister and later the prime minister of Slovenia. And it was easy, just set up. And I came, asked the secretary to give me 15 minutes before minister came. I'd set up my little camera, set up the mics when they came, pen them up. I could see them on the monitor, and I'd fire away and pack up my little camera in my backpack and off to the next.
To the next one.
Next one. So I traveled. I called it my media military service. So I traveled the country with backpack and suitcase and created this whole program called Cold War in Yugoslavia for German TV. So somebody introduced me to people at the Division of Information in Zagreb at the time in 94, and I jumped on a plane in mid-94 and worked there till the end of that year for 6 months. And I filmed in Macedonia at the time. I filmed a bunch of reports. There was an election in 94, so we did a story on what the various candidates in the election from the various parties thought of the United Nations peacekeeping presence. There was a census in Macedonia at the time, one of the first population censuses. So that was interesting because it was the first time Macedonia started to grapple with the ethnic makeup of the country.
And what was the general sentiment of the UN peacekeeping mission?
In Macedonia, people were grateful that there was a UN presence. And eventually, there was a separate UN peacekeeping mission established just in Macedonia, an extension of the UN Protection Force, UNPROFOR, called UNPREDEP, the UN Preventative Deployment Mission. And it was the first preventive deployment mission of the United Nations ever, because they were really intent on preventing spillover of the war into Kosovo and Macedonia, and then infecting and drawing in the neighboring countries, potentially Greece, Bulgaria, and Albania. So that mission was established, and I did stories about there was a big American battalion, there was a Nordic battalion of Norwegians and Swedes and Finns. I remember 4th of July in 1994, the Americans took us with Black Hawk helicopters to all the border posts along the border of Kosovo and Serbia, handing out 4th of July gifts to their soldiers at the posts. We filmed there. It was quite an adventure for me, and I felt I was doing something useful and positive rather than just sitting back and observing it and saying, this is terrible.
Yeah.
And that was, I wanted to do that. And I did stories also on refugee returns. We did letters of peace from various musicians in Croatia and Serbia. Some people criticized us for that.
Right.
Because they didn't want the people and their artists to connect.
Can you give us some examples?
Well, there was Gile from Elektrician Orgasm.
That's the name of the group, isn't it?
Yeah, Gile and Disciplina Kičma, people from that from various groups, and saying we're pleased that our records are sold under the counter in Croatia, even though the authorities had banned it at the time. I wanted to interview Đorđe Balašević. He was up for doing it. I went all the way to Novi Sad. He wanted to send a message of peace across Yugoslavia. But his management decided at the time that it was not good for his career, that things were hotting up, that it could harm his career, and unfortunately it never happened. But we stayed friends when he came to Skopje later. I met Đorđe Balašević again. So we did a bunch of things.
It sounds like you were mobilizing a great deal of commentary in the programs.
Yes, and I met Samantha Power, who's now the administrator of USAID. For a time, she was also American ambassador to the United Nations, and she was a young rookie reporter. And we met in Zagreb. We did a trip together to Bosnia, and in Samantha Power's book about her early career, she mentions me, and there's pictures of us getting in press unit and with Bosnian soldiers at the time. So it was, we met a lot of interesting people, and I met a lot of interesting journalists, some of whom I thought were like war junkies. They were drawn to conflict, and I thought about it, and I thought, what is it about, why are journalists drawn to conflict? Partly it's because it was a way for some of them to fast-track their careers by doing risky things. Partly it was because some people felt, it's weird, but the proximity of death made them feel alive. Maybe they were deadened emotionally back home in England or America or wherever they came from. And the adrenaline of being close to a war was what attracted to them. And I could see that, even though it's not something that attracted me, but I did feel the adrenaline. I did. And
did you come to examine your own reasons?
Well, they were rooted in what my grandmother had said. She never wanted us to experience what they experienced during the Greek Civil War of 1946 to 49, awful things that happened. Before that, the Germans had arrived in across Yugoslavia, Macedonia, and into Greece. She saw awful things, and it wasn't supposed to happen. We said never again, and it did. And then something happened. I started to feel like I'm whitewashing. My job at the UN was a form of whitewashing of what was going on. Because the UN, for many reasons, and I could touch on some of them, at the time, refused to call what was clearly an unfolding genocide by its name. They did not want to use the word genocide. They did various reports, internal reports, in which the word was used, but they remained internal until years later. And part of the reason was that they wanted to keep a broad coalition of countries involved in the so-called UN prevention force, UNPROFOR, UN peacekeeping force. And the Russians were part of it as well. So they wanted to keep them on board. They didn't want to antagonize any one side. And also partly because any of the five permanent members of the UN Security Council could veto anything might have been proposed that was suggesting intervention, suggesting real peacekeeping. Instead, it became a humanitarian operation, and I saw that in a way the humanitarian operation was in some areas feeding the lambs before the slaughter. They were not doing anything about an unfolding genocide. They were saying we're doing the best we can under difficult circumstances, but we can only do so much. Certain battalions, including British battalions, soldiers in the British battalion, complained that our hands are tied. We're seeing awful things that are happening, but we don't have the authority and the mission to do something about it, to really prevent it. And that's when I started to see that here am I working for United Nations TV, doing public relations for United Nations, in effect, at the same time as the United Nations was turning a blind eye to genocide. And I didn't feel good about that. And that's why I only stayed 6 months, from mid-94 till the end of 94. A lot of my colleagues were happy to stay there longer. But towards the end of 94, I got a visit at UNPROFOR headquarters in Zagreb from Arya Naya, who was the co-founder of Human Rights Watch, and who then, at the time, was executive director of the Soros Foundation and the Open Society Institute. And he came to the UN TV offices in Zagreb, and I showed him and various friends stuff that we had filmed, and I said, this is we're turning a blind eye to genocide, and we're recording stuff, and we had material, but we weren't allowed to call it by its name. And Arya Naya said, how quickly can you get me a proposal and a budget for a book about covering the things that you're talking about? And I contacted friends. I said, very quickly. I contacted friends in London. A few weeks later, I saw Arya Naya again at Sarajevo Airport, which became a very dangerous place to land and take off in, because Soviet forces had surrounded it and sometimes even shot at UN planes to show that they're in charge and that they don't respect this international presence. And we agreed that I would get funds to write this book and that I would find experts from around the world to contribute to various chapters. And we created the book called With No Peace to Keep, because it was a peacekeeping force and there was no peace to keep. The subtitle, UN Peacekeeping and the Wars in Former Yugoslavia, which is now available on Amazon, and one can download it virtually as well. And we had 30 world experts who covered various aspects, from American policy to British policy, Russian, French, the humanitarian mission, war crimes, human rights, various aspects. Samantha Power, who I mentioned before, yeah, who later became American ambassador to the UN.
She contributed?
And she contributed a chapter about American policy called Bombing and Negotiating, of how you usually have the upper hand in negotiations if you're bombing, something that the warring parties enjoyed, this upper hand, and which eventually Western forces had to deploy in order to put a stop to the war later also in Kosovo. And throughout 1995, based in London, we were doing this book, coordinating with 30 writers from around the world. I and Ben Cohen, my partner at the time, and various other colleagues. While we were doing it, the massacre in Srebrenica unfolded in July. We didn't publish the book until the end of 1995, so we had several months to include chapters on what happened in Srebrenica in the book. And we brought out the book actually when the Dayton peacekeeping agreement was signed by all warring parties in Bosnia at the end of 1995. So we managed to incorporate the negotiations and that led to the signing of the Dayton Peace Accord, led by Richard Holbrook, American ambassador at the time, who was famous for knocking heads together. So we brought out that book. We launched it at the House of Commons in London. We were favorably reviewed in the New York Times book review, review of books, the New York Times review of books, and other publications. And I and various colleagues actually worked as consultants for a while for various politicians, just briefing them on developments in the war. I updated it a few years later, in 2000, actually updated the book and added several new chapters. And the book also includes every single UN Security Council resolution relating to former Yugoslavia, from the beginning of the conflict till the early 2000s, 2001, just covering the conflict in Macedonia as well.
There's been the latest development. Were you able to include that? I think it's the commemoration of Srebrenica.
Yes. I mean, several things happened after that. Amazingly, it wasn't until 2014 that the United Nations formally declared what happened in genocide. It wasn't until 2014 that the United Nations formally declared that what happened in Srebrenica was a genocide. Previously, in 2012, the Dutch Parliament, which had the Dutch government had a Dutch battalion in Srebrenica at the time. In 2012, the Dutch Parliament resigned en masse and accepted responsibility. The first time this had happened, that any government had accepted responsibility for what happened, and in reports by the Dutch government, they called what happened in Srebrenica genocide. 2 years later, in 2014, in a UN report, it was declared a genocide. It was declared the first genocide in Europe after World War II and the worst massacre in Europe after World War II. It took a long time. And it took a long time for some of the perpetrators, like General Ratko Mladic, to be arrested. He was arrested in 2011. So from 1995 to 2011, that's a long time. 16 years later, 2012, his trial started. It lasted 5 years. 2017, he was found guilty of crimes against humanity and genocide and various other things, and he's still languishing in the Hague. This is one of the outcomes of the establishment of the International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia, which was established in early 90s, I think it was 93, as the war was unfolding, when the United Nations saw the need to create a tribunal for war crimes after it had also failed Rwanda a few years earlier, and it saw that it was necessary. And a lot of people criticized it at the time. They said it was a toothless institution, that it can't do anything. But a lot of high-powered human rights lawyers worked for them, volunteered to work for ICTI, the International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia. It was called ICTI. And eventually they managed to cooperate with regional governments from the region of former Yugoslavia, and various people were arrested, brought to trial. And there was a form of reckoning. There was a form of reckoning, and that was important. As inadequate as the War Crimes Tribunal may have been at times, it was important that such a tribunal was established and that it still exists and that can act as a buffer, can act as a guardian, I suppose, can tell future, current and future perpetrators of war crimes that they will have to answer for what they did. And right now, you have both sides of the conflict between the Palestinians and Israel who have been indicted by that tribunal for war crimes. They don't recognize it, but the indictments are on the table. Some countries do, some countries don't. So without this tribunal, we wouldn't be able to be having this discussion now on how important it is that perpetrators of war crimes eventually are brought to trial and answer for their crimes.
Well, George, it was an extraordinary time in the history of Europe that you were covering, and the publication is equally remarkable, no doubt played a part in the eventual outcome, do you think?
The publication, well, people read it now and quote it quite often in academic works. There's many factors that brought about the end to the war in former Yugoslavia. It didn't completely end in 1995 when the Dayton Agreement was signed in Bosnia. It brewed for some time, and we're still paying the cost of that war. For a long time, and still to this day, there's human trafficking across the region of former Yugoslavia, because for a long time there were weak governments and struggling economies, where it was easy to bribe officials, and human traffickers and criminals thrive in those kinds of environments. So across former Yugoslavia, the criminals held sway, and still do in some ways, and still, because they can always find ways to get, they don't have to play the rules, they can always find ways to get around them. The people who in power, who want to protect law and order, have to play by certain rules. They have to get elected. They can be voted out. Policy can change. So it's difficult to advance the cause of justice and peace. Whereas the criminals, the war criminals, have it easier because they don't have to play by rules. Constantly finding ways to break them, to get around them, to profit from them. So it's no secret, and it's no surprise that criminality still reigns so many years after the blatant war crimes were exposed and brought to justice in former Yugoslavia. So we're still paying that price.
Well, George, I'd like to thank you for your hard work in the past and your passion on the issue and many other issues. Thank you, too, for the publication. And thank you for telling us your story.
Well, next year, Rita, is 30 years, the 30th anniversary of Srebrenica, because it happened in July 1995. So this is the 29th this year. A lot has happened. We are now aware of what happened. There is a wider awareness internationally of the need to prevent something like that happening again. But unfortunately, today in the Ukraine, something even bigger, even more horrific, because of the scale of, sheer scale of it, is unfolding, or has been unfolding now, come 2 years. And it worries me, because what's happening in the Ukraine is Yugoslavia times 10. It's bigger, there are more arms, there are nuclear power stations in the region. Some of them have been used as weapons depots because the Russians have considered that they won't be attacked. And I don't see an easy end to it. I don't see an easy end. So my grandma, who said, "I hope this will never happen again," unfortunately, what she hoped wasn't possible in former Yugoslavia, and again, history is repeating itself in the Ukraine, and I hope one day when it ends that we could look back on the things that are happening still in Ukraine, find ways to rebuild not just the country, but rebuild our attitudes towards war crimes and our responsibility. So what drew me to war reporting was what my grandmother said.
Yes.
That she hoped we would never experience what she experienced in the Greek Civil War, 46 to 49, and the Nazi occupation of the Balkans and Greece before that. Unfortunately, it did happen again. It happened in Yugoslavia, and it's happening now in the Ukraine as well. And an awful conflict is now escalating in the Middle East. And I often think of my granny. And I have to tell her, "Granny, unfortunately, what you wished did not come true." But I felt that whenever I have been able to do something positive in the face of calamity and awful things that were going on, I tried. I did my best.
SBS.
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 SBS Radio.
Сакате ли да чуете повеќе прилози како овој? Слушате подкаст преку Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify или од каде и да ги добивате вашите подкасти.